Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluge, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger will be discussing Parshat Teruma. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual advisor for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Schweiger.
This week's Parsha is Parshat Teruma. The focus of our Parsha is the tabernacle and its utensils. In last year's podcast, we discussed the large question of whether the section in the Chumash is in chronological sequence or not. Is the tabernacle something which is an ideal, or is the tabernacle something which is a concession to the Jewish people in the aftermath of the golden calf? And just to summarize what we mentioned last year, it seems that Rashi feels that the tabernacle is a concession to the Jewish people after the golden calf. In an ideal world, there should be no need to have a tabernacle. There should be no need to have a specific place, material objects with which we worship God. Ideally, we should be able to worship God in the abstract, through study and prayer. But when the Jews demonstrated that they needed to have something concrete, God gave them the instructions to build the temple. Nachmanides is of the school that says the temple is an ideal, and the purpose of the temple is to create a framework which invites the presence of God to dwell in our midst. Last year I mentioned that if you follow this school of thought, you could see the temple as being a blueprint, a model, a mini world that somehow instructs us how we should build our world. There is a very interesting disagreement among the commentaries as to how does one interpret the temple. Maimonides, in The Guide to the Perplexed, tries to explain the different things that are in the temple and tends to give technical reasons. Why is there an altar on which we burn the incense? Because everyone knows that sacrifices have a putrid smell, so that you have to somehow deflect the odor of the sacrifices by offering the incense. Maimonides in The Guide does not relate to the details of the tabernacle and says that the tabernacle had to be built according to some blueprint. The details are irrelevant. What's important is the global picture. There are many commentaries who disagree with Maimonides and seek meaning in the details. And those commentaries also do not look for technical explanations, but for symbolic, spiritual explanations of the tabernacle. In today's podcast, I would like to focus on the ark. The first utensil which is mentioned in the construction, and the most significant utensil in the tabernacle. And let me begin with a detail that is expounded upon in a Midrash that appears in Shmot Rabbah 34:2. This Midrash is on the verse in the Chumash by the Ark, which says, chapter 25, verse 11, "You shall overlay the Ark with pure silver. From the outside and from the inside, you should overlay it. And you should make upon it a gold wreath, crown, all around." I would like to focus on the word crown. In the Hebrew, it is zer. And the Midrash goes as follows. I'm a Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, there are three crowns. The crown of royalty, of sovereignty, the crown of priesthood, and the crown of Torah. The crown of royalty, of sovereignty. That is the table. And he goes on to quote the verse that appears by the table, which has the showbread. This is chapter 25, verse 24, where it says, you shall overlay it, the table, with pure gold, and make to it a gold zer, a gold crown all around. That is one crown. The second crown is the crown of the priesthood. And this is the altar, what is generally called the incense altar, or the inner altar, because it is inside the tabernacle, the temple. And if we look at chapter 30 in the book of Shemot, verse 3, once again, it says, you shall overlay it, it being the altar, with pure gold, its roof, and its walls all around, the horns of the altar, and you should make it a gold crown all around. And finally, we have the verse which I began with, which is in chapter 25, verse 11. And the crown of the Torah, that is the ark, as it is written, and you shall make upon it a gold crown all around. Why is it, this is the Midrash, that by all of them it says you shall make to it, va'asita lo, whereas by the crown, by the ark, it says you shall make upon it, va'asita alav? The answer is, lilametcha, this comes to teach you, that the crown of Torah is greater than all of them. If a person merits Torah, it is if he has merited all of them. This midrash picks up on a detail which we find by three utensils, by the ark, by the table, by the incense altar. In all three cases, it speaks of a crown. And on that basis, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai goes into the symbolism of the three. The ark symbolizes Torah. The table, Jewish sovereignty, peoplehood, royalty. The inner altar, the incense altar, the priesthood. Each of them has a crown. Zer, which is usually understood as a wreath, but also as a crown, is now being understood here as being the crown of all of these institutions. But what does this mean? We know that a crown is worn by a king or a queen. A crown is a symbol of empowerment. If we look at the table has upon it 12 loaves of bread. The 12 loaves of bread correspond to the 12 tribes. The 12 loaves of bread correspond to the prosperity, the well-being of the 12 tribes. According to this drash, it is seen as being a symbol of Jewish sovereignty, of the material well-being of Jewish sovereignty. It is perhaps also seen as a reference to the monarchy, which integrates the 12 tribes, which unifies the 12 tribes, which is the means to bring about the well-being of the Jewish people. Seen in that light, the crown of the table is the crown of Jewish sovereignty, the crown of political power which brings about the glory of the Jewish people. But from the Tanakh, we see that political power was generally a hereditary phenomenon. David is anointed to be the king, and the kingship is supposed to be passed down from generation to generation. Not everyone can merit to be a king. You need to be part of the Davidic line. And it's true that there were kings who were not part of the Davidic line, but this was seen as somehow a corruption, a usurpation, a usurping of what should have been. There is the crown of the kuhuna. As we see in the Chumash, and this will be even articulated in next week's parsha, Parshat Tetzaveh, God chose Aaron and his sons to be the priests. The priests being the ones who serve in the temple. But the priesthood is also a hereditary phenomenon. It empowers a group of people to be the ones who represent the Jewish people in the service of God. It gives them a status above everyone else. But the last crown is the crown of the Torah. And what makes this crown greater than the other ones is that the Torah has the ability to empower a person, any person. It is not a question of heredity. Anyone can now be empowered by their engagement with Torah. It is there for them to take. And ultimately, they create their crown. And that's what makes the crown of Torah greater than the other ones. Because the crown of Torah is open to everyone. It is based on merit. As the Midrash says at the end, if a person merits the Torah, it is as if they have merited the other things. The Torah is there to be taken by people. What they do with Torah is a function of their determination, of their enthusiasm. Each one can create their own crown. If I go back to an earlier verse, in chapter 25, verse 10, when it says, Va'asu aron atzei shitim, and they will make an ark of acacia wood. Once again, we have a midrash from Shmot Rabbah 34:3, which picks up on a little detail. And the midrash, it goes as follows. Why is it that by all the utensils, it says, and you shall make in the singular, whereas by the ark, it says, and you shall make in the plural? Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Shalom, said, God said to Moshe, let everyone come and engage in the ark, so that everyone should merit the Torah. Once again, this little detail, this little nuance, is highlighting the construction of the ark is given to everyone. The symbolism is that everyone has the ability to merit Torah. So let them come and engage it. But what does that really mean? To merit Torah, to engage it, to be crowned by Torah. I would like to now look at another midrash, which is actually quoted by Nachmanides in his commentary on chapter 25, verse 10. This midrash comes from a collection known as Midrash Gadol, a much later collection of midrashim. And let me read it as quoted in Nachmanides. The ark alludes to the righteous scholar who needs to have his inside like his outside. Just as the ark is overlaid with gold on the outside and on the inside, so too should the righteous scholar be. And he goes on to say, just as the bottom of the ark is 2.5 cubits by 1.5 cubits. If I take the squared area, it is a fraction, 3.75 cubits squared. So too should the righteous person subtract from himself, from the four elements of his body, and add on to his righteousness and good deeds, And just as the walls of the ark are 12 cubits, because the length of the walls are 7.5 cubits, the width of the walls in sum total are 4.5 cubits, equaling 12. So too, should the righteous person fulfill the 12 things explicitly stated in Psalms 15. And Nachmanides goes on, above the righteous is the level of the prophets. Corresponding to them is the kaporet, asher al ha'aron, is the cover which is on the ark. The cover alludes to the prophets who are above the righteous. The cover is pure gold, with my insertion, without any wood. And so is the prophet. Complete righteousness. On the cover are the cherubs. They hint to the angels who are above the prophets. They spread their wings above. This alludes to the divine presence, which is above the angels, because the angels are the holy throne, the throne of glory, to receive the glory of the divine presence. And this is the meaning of the verse which says, and to the cover shall be the face of the cherubs. They need to look down below. They're not allowed to stare above them, because God is above everything. What is the meaning of this midrash? Let us analyze it step by step to get a better sense of what the ark is all about. The midrash says the ark is an allusion, alludes to the righteous wise man who needs to model himself after the ark. And it begins by saying, what is one feature of the ark? In chapter 25, verse 11, it says, you shall overlay it with gold from the inside and from the outside. And in fact, there is a brayta which says, the ark was actually a composite of three boxes. A gold box, a wood box, and another gold box. Three boxes that were placed one in the other so that we fulfill the pasuk, which says that the ark on the one hand is made of acacia wood, but on the other hand, it is overlaid with gold on the inside and the outside. How does this midrash understand the symbolism of the ark? The midrash sees the ark as symbolizing the person, the righteous person. The wood would be a symbol of the person's body, his substance, concrete substance. The gold which overlays the wood is the divine element of the human being. And what this is saying is, your outside should correlate to your inside, which goes in both directions. On the one hand, every human being is made in the image of God. Every human being has a divine spark, has a soul, the soul which is inside them. But that soul needs to find expression outside of the human being, in the person's actions, so that the divinity within you should be reflected in what you do, in all of your actions. But there is a flip side to that. The flip side is that the actions that you do should not just be a facade. It is possible for people to seem to be righteous people, but that is a deception, because their righteousness does not reflect their true inner being. Their actions, their words, do not truly reflect what they are thinking, what they are feeling, And therefore, the Midrash is looking at the Ark, which sets a standard. The standard being that if a human being was created in the image of God with a soul, that soul should find its expression outside of you, in your actions. But your actions should always be reflecting what you're thinking, what you're feeling. Your soul's purity should be cultivated and should then be reflected in purity of action. Before I go any further, I want to say that we spoke about the crown of Torah. The crown of Torah, I mentioned earlier, is engagement with Torah. And on the most basic level, engagement means study of Torah. But what we see from this Midrash is that study of Torah is not meant to be an intellectual exercise. The purpose of the study is to be transformative, is to take the Torah and to have it become part of me. Part of me that now brings out my divinity, that empowers me, but empowers me in the sense that I become a being who truly is in the image of God, who reflects divinity in all of my actions. Not only my actions, but my thoughts. This is what the Midrash calls the Tzaddik Hechacham, the righteous wise person. It is very interesting that there is a story told in the Talmud, in Masechet Brachot, page 28, of a dispute in the Beit Midrash between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua, a dispute which led to the deposition of Rabbi Gamliel from being the head of the yeshiva. And one of the things that's mentioned is that during the period that Rabbi Gamliel was the Rosh Yeshiva, there was an elitist policy as to who could enter the Beit Midrash. And Rabbi Gamliel's position was only those whose outside mirrored their inside were allowed to be in the Beit Midrash. But anyone who perhaps did not really reflect the values of the Torah should not be allowed in the Beit Midrash. When Rabbi Gamliel was deposed, the Beit Midrash was opened up to everyone. And it seems from the Talmud that this was actually a very positive development, because there was a study that was done on that day which had never been done before. Issues that had been in doubt were now clarified, so that perhaps Rabbi Gamliel was being too harsh in the policy that he instituted. Although the Talmud seems to suggest that the Beit Midrash should be open to all, and that everyone should be given that opportunity to engage Torah, and I will just add parenthetically, this is something which I certainly subscribe to, teaching at the Pardes Institute. Yet nevertheless, there seems to be a model which is presented with the Ark, a model of the Tzaddik Chacham, of the person who now is embodying the Torah, engages it, but embodies it in every fiber of his existence. The Midrash goes on looking at the dimensions of the Ark and also draws conclusions. If you take the square area of the Ark, it is less than 4 cubits. It's 3 3/4. But that is a message to the righteous person. Diminish yourself. Act in humility. 4 cubits is the space of a person. Don't take up all your 4 cubits. Don't be caught up with yourself. Diminish yourself. And what does it mean to diminish yourself? On the one hand, as I mentioned a second ago, behave with humility. But it would also seem to be that this is looking at diminishing one's material aspirations. what we might call nowadays one's need for self-gratification, if you diminish the material dimension, the material aspect of who you are, that opens you up to increasing your righteousness, to doing good deeds. If I become preoccupied with my material self, it can perhaps diminish, tarnish, dilute my golden spirituality. Why is the sum total of the length and the width 12 cubits? The Midrash says because it correlates to the 12 things mentioned in Psalms 15. There is a very interesting exposition in the Talmud, in Masechet Makot 24a, which says, Rabbi Simlai expounded, there are 613 commandments that were said to Moses at Sinai. But then the Talmud goes on to say that David came and established the 613 commandments into 11 commandments, which means that David somehow reduced the 613 commandments to 11 principles. And then it goes on to expound this verse from Psalms 15, a psalm to David. Who can dwell in your tent? Who can reside on your holy mountain? And then it goes on to list what are the qualities necessary to dwell in the tent of God. First, one who walks with integrity, honesty. Two, one who labors with righteousness. Three, one who speaks truth in his heart. Four, one who does not go spying on his tongue, which is an allusion to gossiping. One who does not do evil to his neighbor. One who does not bear reproach regarding his relative. One who is despised, who is detested in his eyes, or one could probably say, one who despises, one who detests in his eyes those who are despised, one who honors those that fear God, one who swears to do bad, which is understood to flagellate himself, and does not violate his oath. One who does not give his money in usury. One who does not take a bribe regarding someone who's innocent. Whoever does these things will not fall apart. And the Talmud goes on to give examples of different people who actualize all these different qualities. And we don't have the time to go into these, but what I do want to comment is these qualities have to do with a person's spiritual being. Many of them have to do with one's relationship with other people. Integrity, honesty, honor, giving, in no way cheating. This pasuk is seen as creating a standard of behavior. It raises the bar for those who want to dwell in the tent of God, who want to reside on God's holy mountain. This is the standard set for what the Ramban, the Midrash, calls the righteous scholar. As I mentioned earlier, engagement with Torah, which is empowering, is not empowering just that I am now knowledgeable, and knowledge is power, but the power of knowledge is in its ability to transform me, to enable me to transcend myself, to create a standard of behavior that brings me closer to God and brings me closer to my divine image. And when the Midrash goes on and says, the covering of the ark symbolizes the prophets who are all righteousness, the prophets who are constantly scolding the people, trying to bring them to a higher standard of behavior. The moral compass, that is the cover of the ark. And on top of the prophets are the angels. The angels who have no evil inclination. The angels who are pure soul. And they become the chair of glory of God's presence. So that the ark creates this continuum of the righteous scholar connecting to the prophet, to the angel, and ultimately to the presence of God. That link is based on the exercise of tzedek, of righteousness, of justice, of a standard of behavior, a standard of spirituality that we aspire to. The ark is meant to be a model for us of our behavior. I would like to conclude with a remark, two remarks perhaps, made by the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin in the mid to late 1800s, who wrote a commentary on the Chumash called Ha'amek Davar, delving into the matter, going to the depths of the matter, of the word. The first comment relates to the poles which are used to carry the ark. In chapter 25, verse 15, verse 14, you shall bring the poles into the rings on the side of the ark to carry the ark in them. In the rings of the ark shall the poles be, they shall not depart from them. And the Netziv notes that there seems to be a dual function of the poles. The poles are used to carry the ark. Later on we see by the table, there are poles used to carry the table. We find that there are poles for the inner altar. And there are also poles for the outer altar, the Mizbeach HaNechoshet, the altar of copper. And the Netziv notes, with respect to the inner altar and the table, the poles seem to be purely for the purpose of carrying them. But when it comes to the ark and it comes to the outer altar, the poles seem to be not just for carrying them, but are supposed to remain with them so that they're not removed, but they stay there. And the Netziv comments, the ark is symbolic of the Torah. The outer altar is symbolic of service of God. The poles, being an integral part of these two utensils, in effect is saying that Torah and service of God are everywhere, can be transported everywhere. Whereas the table, which symbolizes Jewish sovereignty, the incense altar, which is the priesthood, are more limited in their versatility, applying only in the land of Israel, or primarily in the land of Israel. The Netziv is saying, studying Torah, engagement with Torah, serving God, which in the context of the land of Israel meant temple, sacrifices, outside the land of Israel means prayer. But serving God as prayer can be done anywhere. Engaging Torah can be done anywhere. And the Netziv adds, when it comes to the ark, it can be done anywhere equally. Which therefore means, if I see engaging Torah as being a transformative act, that is not limited to any place. That can happen anywhere. And this is an important message of the poles of the ark. The poles are there ready to take the ark at every moment and make it transportable any moment. Torah is something that can be engaged anywhere, anytime. And let me conclude with another comment of the Netziv. We spoke about the cherubs that are on the cover of the Ark. This is in chapter 25, verses 19, 20, 21, and 22. The Midrash, which I quoted earlier, sees the cherubs as being an allusion to the angels. The Netziv quotes a passage from the Talmud, from Masechet Yoma, which says that the cherubs, in fact, are an allusion to God and the Jewish people. The two cherubs were male and female, reflecting the love relationship between God and the Jewish people. And in fact, according to this passage in the Talmud, this is from Yoma 54a, on the festivals, the ark would be opened up in order to enable the people to see the two cherubs hugging each other, reflecting the love between God and the Jewish people. I would like to end with this by saying, Torah, engagement with Torah, I mentioned earlier, is transformative. But ultimately, engagement with Torah is meant to be an I-thou encounter, an engagement with God. Ideally, it is meant to be a recreation of the Sinai experience. It is meant to be a recreation of the vows taken at Sinai, a renewal of the marriage relationship, not only between God and the Jewish people, but between God and every single individual. May we understand the message of the Ark, so that when we learn Torah, it is not just a question of picking up skills, of feeling empowered, feeling good, that now we are knowledgeable, of being able to perhaps even show off our knowledge. But let us learn Torah with a profound sense of humility, with a sense of how the Torah should be transforming me. By transforming me, it in fact empowers me, because it enables me to transcend myself. But not only do I transcend myself, but opening myself up to the Torah enables me to open up into a real relationship with God, an I-thou encounter. The Ark is at the core of the Mishkan, and the Ark should be at the core of our day-to-day lives. The Ark should be what enables us to not only transform ourselves, but to transform the world, to ultimately bring the presence of God into our world. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode, Pardes from Jerusalem.